My pleasure this morning to introduce to you a world-known artist and fine craftsman by the name of Siegfried Reinhart. When I was asked to do this, Mrs. Soufflo promised me biographical information. She delivered on that promise with the library. And rather than take up a lot of time, as often happens with a lot of biographical data, I picked and chose those things which might be of interest to you. Siegfried Reinhart, the guest for today, was born in 1925 in Germany and came to the United States in 1928. He got into the work of art early in life, and looking at the biographical data from the early years of 1940 on through 58, 59, there was a large series of one-man shows which evidently were very well received. One point of interest that might be interesting for you is in 1962, he did the mural at Concordia Senior College, Fort Wayne, Indiana. And in 1972, here in St. Louis, did the mural at Citibank down on Lindell, just south of the Chase Park Plaza. And I remember when I moved to St. Louis in 79 and opened an account at that bank, I felt it to be a friendly bank, since I noticed on the wall the name of somebody that I had already known and been acquainted with. So that was very nice. Since that time, I've closed my account there, however. It's nothing to do with the artwork. In 1973, he got an honorary doctorate of fine arts from the London Institute for Applied Research, and the Vatican Museum acquired his 1953 painting called Crucifixion. In 1977, he was awarded a doctorate of fine arts and humanities from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, an institution quite familiar to most of us. And the list goes on, and probably the most current and exciting piece of work that Mr. Reinhart is working on is his aviation, which was announced in 1979 as being a mural which would be for Lambert International Airport, and probably will put the airport back on the map. And so with that brief introduction, and obviously leaving out many, many of the important highlights of his fine work and career, I present for you this morning Mr. Siegfried Reinhart.
Thank you all very much. It's my pleasure to be here. I've been here before. The thing I thought I would talk about, there's a certain restriction on time, I understand. I'll try to make this as brief as possible, although it is a little statement that I did some time ago, which is called Reality and the Creative Force. And this was done to honor Dr. Philip Hefner, who was a good friend of mine. I made a drawing of him, and it's in a book that was published in October 31st of 63. In rereading this a number of times, I feel that it's comprehensive enough as far as I'm personally concerned, so that it is still applicable. Although there are certain things probably that would have changed in the context of, in which this was conceived and written. But it deals with a very broad theme. It's open to all sorts of questions. Contains a multitude of philosophical implications of all kinds, and rather than discuss the variations on that theme, we might just as well get directly into the thing. And I said the title of this thing is called Reality and the Creative Force, and it's part of a list of essays that were contributed to this book called The Nature of Grace in honor of Dr. Joseph Sittler. Okay, and Mr. Hugh Hefner was the gentleman responsible for the whole thing. It was printed by the Fortress Press. Okay, so reality and the creative force, if you please. Now then, reality is a perplexing word, a word that has defied virtually every speculation about its meaning. My own, now when I say my own, it's first person singular, it's my attitude, my personal point of view, which may be in conflict with a lot of others that are broad and open and God knows what else. But in any event, my own conception of its meaning varies with every new variety of experience, whatever that may mean. Therefore, a dogmatic, consistent, static, and immutable definition of reality is for me personally, a singular impossibility. The reality of the external world as perceived and reacted to through the physical agency of the biological senses is, on a fundamental level, and at this level, these senses deliver a very specific and indisputable form of what I would call reality. This is wood, that's the floor, this is the ceiling. This is basically the animal level, the level upon which the protoplastic combinations congeal to produce the form of awareness that characterizes, quote, natural man. Fire, water, earth, and air exist as real forces providing the basic dynamics which make the human condition possible as a physically unified masterpiece of mobility. Now then, the respect which this form of reality deserves is one, as my own opinion, of endless awe. It's just an absolute miracle. For a painter, the endless varieties which matter assumes in the physical world, which are perceived and examined and finally used, form the basic patterns of response, which begin to define the nature of the artist as a physical agent of nature, in nature, and himself as an extension of nature. Now, there are some people that I've discussed this with who disagree with that. That's their problem. This reality obviously must have a prior existence in the form of nature, and it's parenthetical, and all that nature implies, defines, and otherwise produces, before any other form or conception of reality is indeed possible. Moreover, reality, so perceived, underlies as, quote, fact, all systematic conceptions of nature, and as such, it is contained in these conceptions. Fact and reality, so defined, are essentially one and the same thing. This is wood, this is a fact, we all agree. If we don't, we have a problem. Without the pre-existence of the fact, which allows us to say with absolute incontestability, or contestability if one chooses, that something is. Reality, as a material conception of the material world, would be impossible if we couldn't talk about reality in these terms. Things one sees and understands relative to that concept of vision and the things related to definitions. To attempt to define what a fact is as an absolute and you know, I got something going here. Okay, I'm sorry. There's a little error in this thing here. Excuse me just one little second here. Whoop. The whole page missing here, would you believe it? I wasn't aware of that. Okay, yeah, we go on then. To attempt to define what a fact is as an absolute and irreducible means by which reality is apprehended and thus acted upon is essentially beyond the scope of this whole paper here. Moreover, its controversial character in the semantic sense would provoke inexhaustible forms of argument unrelated to these paragraphs, the statements I'm making. It is sufficient for me to accept both fact and reality in their most popular sense, which is to say on the level of physical appearances, the one which is least critical. For me, this must be and is the point of origin of life as a painter, both physically and spiritually. This particular conception of reality is rooted in the brute data of human awareness, is basic to existence. It is, in its own particular way, one form of the so-called higher realities. Now then, a higher reality is a form of reality which resides in the human intelligence and which is expressed in ideas and abstractions of thought. It is not articulated through a system of facts, as attempted to have been described above, but rather owes its gestalt, its conception, to conceptions of truth. Here again, truth, traditionally acknowledged as the highest form of enlightened reality, assumes a study of the history of philosophy once reveals an indescribable number of interpretations. Perhaps the most impressive revelation of truth as an absolute and mystically transcendent reality which must be spiritually discerned to be accepted and understood as immutable is contained ultimately in the triune complexity of Jesus Christ. He states, quote, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Such total finality of conviction and purpose, insofar as human experience is concerned, has probably no parallel in its claim to be, quote, the truth. Now, as far as I'm concerned, no human intelligence can begin to grasp even a fraction of such an infinite divine manifestation of ultimate reality. The most that can be said is that dogmas which enclose the mystery of truth embodied in the triune complexity of Christ are accepted unequivocally in order to disclose the means by which such divine and final reality is at least accessible. There is another way of seeing, which is on a level that has nothing to do with talking, ultimately. It's feeling and whatever else. Now then, the reality of truth on this level of experience, on which the divine is accessible, occasionally makes all other searching seem altogether futile and are unnecessary. Now then, the creative force in conflict, next part of this. My own personal confrontation with Christ as a final, the final, and only answer for life has fluctuated and is fluctuating between unquestioning belief and disbelief at times. The continuous dialogue between the power of the will which seeks to believe and the will to power which seeks autonomy in itself and thus to disbelieve expresses itself openly in a substantial part of my work. At the root of this duality lies a profound desire to reconcile all human energy, thought, and experience and that which it produces with a principle of divinity to which and from which all forces of creation flow. Now there's one attitude which I cannot permit myself, and that is to deny or to suppress in any way, really, the existence of conflict that can assume many and multitudinous kinds of forms, frustration, and even failure. It is essentially in the acknowledgement of these turbulences of human mind and spirit that much of my work ferments until finished surfaces emerge, which mirror the emotional and intellectual conflicts by which they were engendered. Now then, the reality of conflict, which is to say the flesh versus the spirit, disbelief versus belief, etc., constitutes the basic pattern of my theme as a painter. However, the truth and the reality of conflict are by no means to be construed as the exclusive forces by which aesthetic forms are released. Impulses of an infinite variety stir and flash in both mind and spirit and cause the realization of aesthetic form. They can come out of absolutely nowhere and frequently do, which is inexplicable. I don't know how to get into any descriptive analysis of how that works, except that I react to it. The creative force is, as it were, in perpetual motion and draws its propelling energies from intangible responses to ideas and insights which culminate in a sustaining drive, which is the truth, and hammer and hammer and hammer for hours and hours, days and days, months, even years, to make, quote, a work of art. The creative force further manifests itself in that its irritant capacity in mind and body generates a compulsive energy which causes a work of art to come into existence. Very often, doing certain things, suddenly, boom, something happens, and I am completely out of context with what I'm into, and I've got to get going at the thing. It has its own way of demanding it. It's very strange. I've got to learn how to discipline myself. It provides a sustaining charge, this sudden oncoming, of what in German is known as Anwendungskraft, or the ability to perform in direct ratio to what is required to complete that performance. Now, I do not mean to convey the impression that the creative force is lodged in some subconscious sector of the human spirit and that it functions as an independent spiritual drive which is uncontrollable and fugitive and which in turn exhausts the artist as though he were afflicted with some progressive fatal disease, although in some instances that may seem to be the case. And I can talk about that briefly, but it doesn't matter. On the contrary, although the circumstances of the existence of the creative force in one person and evidently not in another, must thus always remain mysterious. It is an exalting energy which exacts the highest act of discipline and ardor in man. One point of view, the existence of the creative force in one person and not, or at least evidently not, in another, is ultimately simply a question of degree. Since it seems altogether obvious that man at large, and an ideal conception of his state of being is designed to be constructive, a builder, a creator. Now, frequently they require certain things to be torn down in order to do something hypothetically better. Now, there are all sorts of arguments that go on regarding this. But suffice it to say that essentially the impulse and the human organism in its essential form is designed to be a builder, to be constructive, to be creative, if you will. This is true in the collective sense. All men enjoy, in varying degrees, to be sure, some portion, to some extent, the creative force operating in them, whether they're capable of acknowledging it or not. Now then, the artist, the symbol, and God. The creative force and its ability to inspire in man any given number of actions which transcend his animal-bound nature represents that force whereby some comprehension of divinity is possible. Now then, the, quote, image of God, unquote, if one permits such a speculation, seems to me to be the participation of divinity in the spiritual content and substance of man in the form of the gift of the creative force. No creative force is greater than that we call God. More extended speculations about the image of God seems altogether futile, no matter how subtle, informed, and penetrating they might be. Moreover, they are inconsequential somehow, since descriptive investigations into the nature of God reveal, ultimately for me at least, and I say this is all first person singular, nothing necessarily decisive, useful, or perhaps even valid, except, again, as a symbol, symbolizing an attempt to describe something that seems indescribable. Now, then, an elaborate system of visual symbols oriented upon God has been developed as a substitute for such speculation in an effort to embrace the Godhead and its Christian triunity, that is to say, the attempt to render visible the invisible. The power of the symbol and its capacity as an interpretive adjunct for any theological system is not only obvious, but seems to me altogether indispensable. The symbol is, in point of fact, precisely that form by which a mystery can be disclosed and makes human communication possible. Without the symbol, no form of communication in any precinct of life, it seems to me, could probably exist. It seems that way to me in any case. Now then, the symbol is finally the only means by which any aspect of life can be comprehended, examined, evaluated, accepted, rejected, or simply ignored. That's included philosophical systems, generate ideas, thoughts, whatever. Whether the symbol be, as Joyce Carey states, quote, thing, word, gesture, ballet step, building, it is a compound of concept and associations. Life and symbol are, it seems to me, synonymous and concentrically indivisible. Now then, my life as an artist is perhaps far more consciously involved with the symbol than that of the so-called non-artist, since virtually everything with which I am engaged is related to the articulation of symbol and symbolic systems. The recreation of the visible world and its contents on flat surfaces, whether on gesso grounds or in colored glass or however, is essentially an act of transforming disorganized experience into an imaginative system of symbols which are designed to reflect an affirmation of life, in my particular case, as it is lived in the awareness of divine control and authority. Now that's an act of faith. And I do believe that. You can test it any way you choose, but that's the way it is. They extract from physical appearances and experience a pattern of living in which bread alone, quote unquote, as it were, is the ultimate symbol of fulfillment and of reality. Now then, for me, such a conception of life asserts that existence alone as a genetic imperative in the accidental process of birth is, quote, the way, the truth, and the life. And it acknowledges nothing independent of this decisive principle. Now, for me, such a view finds it extraordinarily difficult to accept that which is invisible, transcendent, and silent, revealed through the agencies of divinely inspired prophecy as the one, the only, and the final means by which truth is made accessible. Yet to attempt to conceive of any system of life without the promise of immortality predicated on a set of values which elevate animal existence to a state of being in which divinity governs achievement and worth, as at times equally as difficult for me. Thus, in my own view of life at this point in time, which relies far more on what I do than on what I am, the presence of the divine principle simply cannot be excluded. Now, then we have a non-philosophical aesthetic. Now, this statement is, in fact, considerably less the result of logic than of training theological, quote-unquote, brainwashing, as it has been characterized by some, and my mother was a brainwasher from the cradle up. No matter what system of philosophy I've examined, no matter how great the temptation to engage my thought in this often profoundly relevant core of revelation and insight, I have found it finally unpersuasive unless the author acknowledged somehow in the context the divine principle as the governing force of life. This is, to be sure, an emotional response, a subjective contraction of responses which mirrors an attitude that is probably improper for any intelligent and valuable examination of any philosophical thought. I must express whatever I consider important enough to express in any definitive form as an artist and not as a philosopher addressing himself to the problems of ontology. Yet a concern, a kind of nagging preoccupation with the problem of being, is contained in most of what I do ultimately as an artist. This preoccupation results essentially in a non-philosophical aesthetic. This aesthetic operates on a level in which idea assumes a plastic, visible character, in which a visual resolution is reached in terms of aesthetic principles described and achieved in what is known, referred to as the tradition of art. Now then, in his Theology of Culture, Dr. Paul Tillich makes a statement which has developed into a rather extraordinary chapter in many ways concerning Picasso's Guernica. I hope you're all familiar with that thing. That was recently sent back to Spain. Okay. Tillich writes, quote, Picasso's Guernica is a great Protestant painting. And it goes on. And, quote, he proceeds to qualify this statement in an effective and penetrating analysis in terms of, again, quote, the human predicament in our period, and concludes with, quote, the only thing we can do is to keep ourselves open for a new rise of religious art through the expressive style in the art of today, end quote. And I have a tendency to agree with that. In essence, this brief chapter contains, for me at least, a lucid examination of content and style in terms of the aesthetic principles which govern a conception of what religious art is or at least ought to be. The absurdity of an exclusive, denominationally restricted art is most certainly, unfortunately, dismissed through this thoughtfully exact statement of Tillich's. Has anybody here read that at all, Tillich's? Okay. Theology of Culture. It's a fascinating book. This statement, as I comprehend it, states precisely what an artist is about when he resolves a series of forms based on a major human theme and conceived within the framework of an allegory. The forms and distortions of form, as they writhe, twist, and scream in this Guernica painting, I wish I had a reproduction of it here so you could all see it, are not representations of torment, agony and suffering. They are themselves, in themselves, precisely those negative qualities of power realized in the medium of painting. That is to say, destruction, human fear, guilt, and tragedy are contained in the very act of the painting itself. Now, I wish only to emphasize here that though I may not agree with his particular choice of Guernica as a great Protestant painting, that's a personal matter, I do agree, however, with the intention of this analysis, since its penetration reveals the intention of the artist in our time as an aesthetic force no longer concerned with neoclassical motives in search of beauty, quote unquote. This, to be sure, does not apply to every artist in the same way, and there'd be a bunch of people that would react very, very unfavorably to that statement. That's okay. The expressionist style in painting that Tillich mentions is not the only style through which profound and totally relevant, timeless, if you please, works of art are achieved. And I feel that anyone that makes an attempt to try to describe what a timeless piece of art is in for a large, large problem. I wouldn't know how to begin that. However, in our time, the artist, fully dedicated to the singularity of a great aesthetic achievement through his own craft, cannot be disengaged from the physical world of men and events, and yet a great many are. Retired into their own cave, and the world out there does not exist. Quote, the ivory tower is no longer, at least for me, understand, it's all first person sitting there, I keep repeating that, a habitable domain, if significant relevant works of art are to be produced, which speak, quote, from the condition of man as both a creator and a destroyer. Beauty, harmony, ardor, and balance, words traditionally related to descriptive examination of works of art, become altogether superficial and meaningless as guiding principle for their production, since they are the byproduct of an art achievement, and not the means by which art is achieved. Now, this is essentially what Tillich is saying in his own way, and I'm paraphrasing this in part, which is to suggest that I really agree with him. The creative force, which is an intuitive mechanism of perception and action, instinctively imposes a system of organization on the unpredictable chaos of human experience, whereby selection and rejection of values become automatic and intrinsic to the process of response. Whatever, quote, beauty, harmony, ardor, balance, and so on, emerge in and through a work of art, emerge merely, as far as I am concerned, as a secondary and unconscious sequence of ardor, which in no way makes that thing a work of art. Neither do style, technique, color, line, form, shape, and all other such means, no matter how brilliantly they may be employed, make a work of art in themselves. These are not the means by which these are accomplished. Finally, emotion, feeling, articulation of space, energy, intensity, optical dissonance, impact, and all other such abstract human qualities, irrespective of combination and effective matter, mastery, do not necessarily make a work of art. A work of art contains, in any given variety and number, all of the aforementioned in, obviously, a variety of degrees. A work of art is the work engendered through the human spirit and contains the mercurial quality of the presence of a divine force, which we call the creative force, through which all of its elements are magnetized to create a response of continuous as well as sustained revelation. And this is a personal matter with the artist working in his own world, adjacent to the world he's in. Thus it is, it seems to me, that certain works of art achieve, finally, frankly, a kind of divine state of being. And I've encountered such things in Europe, going through some of the museums when I was there in 1960, which no amount of time, history, or human vicissitude could alter or ignore. And in point of fact, the Isenheimer altar by Matthias Grünewald is one such a miracle, and the Avignon Pietà, which is also a very fantastic painting, triptych, another. And the Ghent altar by the Van Eycks is still another, and it goes on and on. And it's unnecessary to list them all because I couldn't do that to begin with. It doesn't really matter. Now, the artist is an existentialist. In conclusion, whatever I've attempted to achieve with this paper, this group of statements, in the final analysis, is actually achieved with varying degrees of success, ultimately in the form of the painted surfaces. I could not assume to develop an illuminating group of statements and expect illumination to ensue, since what I have said is stated from where I stand. I wish I were to make a final statement in the form of sort of a brief summary. It appears altogether clear to me that the artist, with respect to his biological nature as a human being, must know that his reality as brute fact and all the other relationships established by and through it are absolutely imperative to his life as an artist. The physical world, in its endless proliferation of form and matter, constitutes the source of supply through which his mode of production achieves its tangibility as a meaningful work, rendered through the gift of his creative force. In this sense, I find it difficult, ultimately, to dissuade myself from the idea that, fundamentally, an artist is, somehow, an existentialist. And more specifically, in that form of being characterized in Kierkegaard as, quote, the single one. The frustrations inherent in mind and spirit, the conflict for identity, and the struggle for and with faith, as Kierkegaard experiences in his fear and trembling, point up for me the restless nature of the artistic sensibility and its exhausting attempt, ultimately, to reconcile itself with divinity. The artist, moreover, in spite of himself, as an organic accident, and that's true of anyone else for that matter, reflects the action of divinity by the sheer force of his role as a creator. And therefore, his creative activity is an inadvertent affirmation, or a very conscious attempt to be and reflect the image of God in man. The reality of his work, irrespective of its form or character or style, is essentially the sole preoccupation to which his life is surrendered, and that's certainly true in my case. And in his work, the attempt to reach and embrace a cosmic reality of meaning makes him essentially an agent of visionary proportions. Whether he works in a conscious awareness and dedication to God in a very real and conscious manner, and expresses this gratitude through such dedication, which I make every effort to attempt to do in any case, or whether he does not, somehow cannot alter or distort the reality of the existence of the creative force in him, which is the major abstraction. Which is to say, finally, as far as I'm concerned, the active presence of divinity in the flesh of man. And that's essentially all I have to say about it. We can go on and on and on with that. But that's basically the paper, and that's it. I stopped, I guess, plenty of time, didn't I?
Yep, that's just fine. Thank you very much. I think we'd like to throw it open for questions now. Does anybody have a comment or a question that they would like to present? Yes.
When you refer to the techniques of the artist as not making the work of art, or even certain criteria which have been set up by art historians and analysis, not necessarily making the work of art, you still hold, don't you, that the artist has to be adept.
True, agreed. As a matter of fact, there are a great variety of schools of painting in recent years, developed post-war phenomenon really in many ways, where subject matter, for example, artists deny in every way that that a subject is necessary, that to make a form is absurd and unnecessary. It's all been done. So that a lot of the subject matter, content of a lot of contemporary painting, abstract expressionism, and we have a multitude of others, minimalism, and there are about 40 different isms. A substantial number of these kinds of or methods and forms of painting have nothing to do with content at all, except to say that what makes those things, quote, alive, meaningful, is the energy that produces them. And energy as an abstraction becomes the real thing that makes that a valid, quote, work of art. And beyond that has no other significance. Now, I take a great exception to all of that, quite naturally. I'm a traditionalist in some way, quite clearly that. And I've argued with all kinds of people in all sorts of places about this kind of thing. Yes, ma'am. Okay, that's possible. One could very clearly develop an interpretation regarding that and probably make a reasonably decent point of it. Right. Well, now, I know that one thing in Semitic religion, the image of God has become a very significant do not. That's forbidden. And Agam was a Jewish painter who's not a painter, really. He designs these very clear, they're very, very lovely, actually, abstractions that are printed, and they have some of them that things close over each other, and they change the images, as it were. But he was very explicit, very clear when he addressed the group at Washington University, I think it was about 4 years ago, perhaps. And I attended this, and he said one thing, made it absolutely clear. He says, I'm an artist, but in no way will I permit myself ever, because it is forbidden, the first commandment of God, thou shalt not make graven images. Therefore, he doesn't even paint a flower. That's also a singular manifestation of God in some way. So, he said, my problem is afflicted with this desire to do. I've had to invent my own forms. So he does it with color and with shapes. And if anyone accuses him of having seen set shapes that exist somewhere, this thing looks like something that exists in nature, he would instantly get all shook up. Because he said, anything that he does can in no way reflect an image of any kind. It would be a violation of the first commandment of God, thou shalt not make graven images. And that includes can't even paint dogs or portraits or anything related to that. Beg pardon?
He's an exception.
I would say, in this case, true. And he admits this. He said, I know I'm way out there somewhere, no one. But he's also very successful. Whatever that means. Okay. Yes. Oh.
You mentioned in passing a couple of times about art and being. There's a book by Dr. Assam, Homer's Art and Scholasticism, in which he tries to make a bit more precise the relationship between art and being, more precise than you offer.
Mm-hmm.
But also in passing, Marathon says that there's a problem with aesthetics today, as it's usually studied in courses and whatnot.
Right. Well, I think it's, yes, up to a point, which is to say, I think it's, my attempt here to even suggest that somehow it's an error to try to analyze and reduce and say, finally, this is the thing that causes this to happen, this and only this, and anything else that doesn't produce this kind of thing as a consequence of this response to a life system or style or whatever, intellectually or emotionally. There's no way, it seems to me, that I could, that I, for instance, could ever clearly, carefully, and communicate intelligently about a separation of parts and pieces that make up a total unit. I cannot begin to describe how, when I work on some of this, a good deal of it is governed by an intellectual response, I suppose, stylistically, taking a form and distorting it, instead of reproducing it like a camera might, for instance. There was a time, and currently, a lot of people react to so-called photographic realism, in which a lot of the painters, actually a school of them, are using large blown-up photochromes and just simply applying paint over those things, and those are, quote, works of art. Okay. There I run into some difficulty with that. This is not from the human organism, this is through a mechanical device that this is accomplished. Now, you can argue forever about the validity of this, but relative to intellect and emotion, I find it very difficult to make a separation between the two things. I know that when I finally get to a surface, I have rather carefully cleared out stuff that I consider unrelated to what I'm trying to achieve with this particular statement. And so I guess, unequivocally, the intellect plays a rather distinct part in making choices and decisions with regard to this. I think it's all interrelated in some way. I don't think you can separate one thing and say, only because of this, this happens. This isn't true. And you get other response from other people, of course, from other artists working. As I said, there are some who deny, like Ed Reinhardt, that spells his name exactly the way I do, paints great big black things. There should be no subject, there should be no image, there should be no color, there should be no form, there should be no substance, there should be no idea, there should be no intent. There should be no objective, it should have no meaning, it should not be full of anything at all that confuses, distorts, and conflicts with what one is constantly used to. Art is ultimately a statement about a state of being which contains no subject, no image, essentially has no meaning. He's a hero. Amen. Yes.
To what extent are you, as a Christian artist, bound to Scripture, or to what extent are you an exegete of Scripture?
Well, okay, that's I was trying to get at in some way here. There's a continuous flow and flux of this. I would say clearly that a lot of work that was circulated in the church in a very broad way, like Hoffman's painting of the head of Christ. Now, I have no quarrel with that, ultimately. That's his own affair. He's achieved that. And that's his business. But for my own personal, private response, it's Christ is as an image. It's too effeminate. It's too whatever. I read scripture, find this man going through this, and it's the word that was made flesh, dwelt among us, struggling like he did, achieving what he accomplished. Somehow couldn't look like that. I just can't achieve it. I just can't conceive of that in the context in which this has worked out. Because agreed that Christ is a beautiful thing. But finally, in that sense, I can't conceive of Christ beyond the three-dimensional reality of Christ as a man, and to identify his physical presence and going through the things that he had gone through, if that were at all possible, just through the imagination, stumbling around in Jerusalem as he did with having the troubles and difficulties. I can't imagine a guy that's all done up, you know, like that. Just that bothers me. To me, that is not an image of Christ. A strong, forceful person. And as I say, this is private and personal. Some people look at that and say, no way, I can't buy that. That's their problem, you know, as opposed to mine. Then I have a problem. Don't you see the beauty of Christ? Of course I do. But it's not that kind of beauty. It's not expressing these physical lines or forms, as far as I'm concerned. There's a certain intensity of agony about his. And he even needs a human, ultimately. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he screamed out, God, you know, I don't want to go through this routine. And the angel came down and said, you've got to, okay. So that it's that part of the humanity of Christ that I talk about and that I can identify with in a very real and living way. And a lot of the work produced in the name of this holy non-entity, you know, bothers me. I have trouble with it as an image of Christ. Because the way I can identify with it is Christ alive as another human, but a divine origin. And if we are Christ-like and attempt to achieve that, this is part of the continuous struggle in this context, as far as I'm concerned. Which is why my Christ figures are not necessarily beautiful people. As this would clearly indicate, the guy is struggling and suffering. And yet, underneath all of that, there's this great big universe of God that come unto me. It has nothing to do with the way you look. But to convey something of the what seemed, according to scripture, the evident struggle, tough problems, to try to live like that and work that way, I don't see how anybody could have his hair combed all day long and look like a movie star made up. That bothers me, okay?
Anybody else?
Yes, ma'am.
Well,
anybody
else?
Oh, well.
Anyone over there, please?
Oh, excuse me, yes.
Okay, I would consider this to be your most, your best artistic statement.
Ooh, that's difficult. I really don't know how to answer that one, frankly. I'm serious, and I'm not joking about that. I can't really say. Because I know that when I'm literally working on those things, at the moment I'm into the whole thing, no matter when it is or where it is, whether the time I was doing this or the time I did that or what I'm currently into, I feel that this is not necessarily it. This is not the best thing I'm doing because I have faith in the fact that I can live a while to keep on going. But at that time, when I'm doing what I'm into, every conceivable form of energy that I can apply to this thing to make it the very best that I'm capable of doing is what I have to do, and that's what I do. And I can't really say that one thing is necessarily better than another. There are things that have taken much longer time than others, and the fact that I may have spent a couple of years working on one thing and maybe 4 days on another does not make the one that I spent all that time on any better than the one I spent a few hours on. So I don't know how to judge that. And I can't say that. And the things that I ultimately, when I finally get through or think I do, When I quit painting, on a day, I'm working on about 10 or 12 different things simultaneously. When the thing I'm working on begins to lose its, I just put it aside and sell something. And very often I come back 3-4 months later, for that matter, coming through it, and something strikes me that's completely unrelated to what started out to be to begin with. And it changes, work on it some more, and then it emerges as something else. So that I'm saying, ultimately, the creative process is a continuous flow of just things that happen and are very difficult to in any systematic way, describe and say, because A equals B, C therefore. And find a formula that works every time. I don't work like that. I've never been able to, that is to say, successfully. Done a lot of commercial work, which is nothing but skill. And I'm capable of making drawings and doing that kind of thing without investing any of myself, really, emotionally into the thing. That becomes like a machine, a robot. I can do that. And I think I can, yes, rather briefly. We're all familiar with the story of the Good Samaritan. I hope so. Okay, well, this developed as a consequence, really, of... I've always been enthralled with that story because I am convinced of one very basic principle about my own life, and that is to live is ultimately but to give, and to give in all kinds of ways. And if you receive, okay, but that's not the force that generates the giving process. And a physician friend of mine, as a matter of fact, it's sort of a variation on a theme of the guy holding this poor man. He spent a substantial part of his life just giving his, rendering his service for nothing to all kinds of people, to wayfarers, you know, people that stumble and fall. You pick them up and take care of them. And that to me symbolizes even STEM students, everything about what they're into. They are to give, to help, to support, to whatever. So by analogy, this is the reason for having chosen that as a theme. Simply because it's so clearly, it seems to me, demonstrate that very physical action of giving. You give psychologically, you give physically, but it's an act of giving. And I feel that that's what the seminary is all about. In a way, you guys are here to eventually give out. And that, I mean, beyond that, and the rest of that is just based on the cross, obviously, is there to signify that this is a Christian impulse, which is very strong and very powerful. And those are the barren hills, I guess, of Jerusalem or wherever. So there's some semblance of the architecture of the place, the space and time in which this happened in all probability. But other than that, the basic message there is to support, to help, to give. Yes? Oh, the endless pit of hell. Be careful. Don't go near that thing. You avoid it. Walk around it. Because there is a way down. Yes, yes. Anything else? Yes?
As you look back on your career and life as an artist, have you gone through any definite stages that you can now see are noticeable and work in certain techniques or certain media?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's, oh, sure. Yeah, that's a good question because very clearly that has happened. I spent 25 years working in stained glass windows, which requires a very specific kind of discipline, which is different altogether from the kind of one uses in painting. These are all technical matters. But in style, a significant question, is when I was working this way,
way back in 51, I guess, yeah, whatever.
At that time, I was so heavily entrenched in designing with glass, working with glass, that it would be easy enough to take this whole thing here and just put lead around it. Not easy. That'd be much more difficult to do with that. Because when I'm working in glass, I was working with the flat stuff and the light was coming through. Without the light, this thing would never be seen. But it required a certain way of thinking, a certain kind of discipline in the concept of designing for glass that then sort of automatically translated itself into my own painting. So paintings of that time when I was into glass, which is, say, roughly from 1948 through about 65, 65, 68, whatever, about 25 years. There was in the beginning a stylistic relationship to glass, very clearly. It was governed by very rigid forms and with the conception that around them lead would go. And that translated itself into my painting, so it was very strongly influenced. As there's a distinct style, which is in ways quite different from that one up there, for instance, which is handled somewhat more atmospherically. There's not much, frankly, sort of atmosphere, except to say the atmosphere here again. If this were done in glass, you just run the thin lead through all this and you can achieve that. But that is not true in that one up here. So that the space concepts have changed. And I guess I'm working, I refer to myself as a proto-allegorical surrealist. Now you can have to make out of that anything you choose.
I wanted to ask you a question about the different types of things that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find a difference in the way you approach, for instance, a piece of religious art as opposed to a mural for Citibank?
Oh, sure. Largely because of the subject matter involved. The Citibank, Phil Lichtenstein, when he offered that commission, he said, here's the wall, do anything you want. I could have done all sorts of things. And I thought that very carefully, and okay, bank, money, amen. That was, you know, sort of self-determined. So I suggested to him that I would do something based on the theme of the story of money. He said, fine, that's okay. Just so you get it up there. Well, to make a long story short of the whole thing, I mean, I had a ball doing this because that was the first time I got into reading about currency, methods and means of exchange through time, at least in this country, and discovered all sorts of interesting, strange little facts about currency, what was used as legal tender in certain civilizations and times and places. Now, in the early beginnings of the colonization of America, and the South particularly, in Virginia and the Carolinas, tobacco and horses were exchanged as legal tender. That represented money. You didn't have to have this. You had horses, you had money, you could work. And it was like a border system arrangement. Well, it goes on and on. And it came into all sorts of interesting things regarding money. And then I painted this mural, starting with that very primitive stuff in the beginning. It all started from God's earth. We picked up things, found diamonds and whatever else. And the time progressed into the values. Gold was found, silver, etc. And then these other systems were established. So there was a very broad overview of the development of money as exchange through the current world. And that's sort of what's indicated in that mural up there. And I had written a brief little statement about it, and I think when you go to the bank, they hand it to you. It explains what's going on up there. But as I said, yeah, that's a different kind of investment. As opposed, for example, to the one I'm currently working with, Man's Conquest of Space and Aviation in American Triumph, the subtitle of that. There that has some sort of broad spiritual overtones in some way. For instance, there's some jokes to go with this. I got a couple of postcards. I think that one of the funniest ones is a very beautiful thing, a big black postcard someone sent me. It wasn't a postcard, it was a card sent in an envelope. I opened this thing up, and it said in gold letters on this black background, if God intended man to fly, he would not have invented railroads. Which meant quit. Hey, all kinds of crazy stuff like that. But there again, now, in that kind of a mural, the things that I'm really into there, I try very hard to achieve something that transcends this, just the enclosure of the program of flight, flying a mechanical machine and a man in it flying around. There's a lot more involved in this whole concept. And I hope that's conveyed in this mural. Seven sections, which are all 20 feet long, 8 feet high, and they're all connected mixed. A unit that would be 142 feet long and 8 feet high, which is half the length of a football field. It's kind of a long thing. And every one of those units are really loaded with information. And I spent 2.5 years at least doing nothing but just researching this thing. I read well over 300 books. Went to the Aerospace Museum on four different occasions. And out here to Parks College and McDonnell Douglas, what was available, information at the airport, etc. Spent a lot of time in a variety of libraries getting this all together. And it's, I got so enthralled with the whole program that that's all I've been doing. And so I started the mural, as I said, and I realistically told the guys that it would be a minimum of 2.5 years just to execute this thing, get this really off the ground, and to finish it in that length of time. Well, we got it going. I got it going in such a way so that it started to generate its own kind of energy. It was just completely absorbed in this thing. To the end that I've got about 3 weeks left to finish the last panel, and we are clearly one whole year ahead of the deadline schedule, which is fine. But that's what I'm trying to suggest about getting involved. It has nothing to do with money, because, I mean, I finally, I'm doing it for less than half of what we asked for, and it's costing me now money to do this thing, finish it. But I don't care about that. It's important that this thing be finished, and this is a project that I feel very intensely about. So that is the source of the energy for it. It has nothing to do with whether I get paid or not. I don't really care. So very often those things happen. In this instance, this is one of those cases where that has happened.
And maybe we can take one more question?
Possibly. Yes. Yes, sir.
Back to the question about the bank, it sparked off something in my mind about fees in general. There seems to be a great discrepancy, not only among your particular field of artists, but among musicians. And
I believe that, yes.
From those of international stature to those of local fame.
Okay.
And that's caused me some problems intellectually, trying to balance out the equity of that whole thing.
Well, only to tell you that that is probably the largest single mystery extant in the human condition at large. I have no idea how, except that I can understand the rationale of how this works and how this has finally been developed. But the phenomenon of values placed on, quote, works of art and things that people are willing to pay and all this kind of stuff, this really amazes me. I have no way of determining that. How and why Jackson Pollock, who was a friend of mine, I knew him when he was still a student working with Thomas Hart Benton. And Thomas Hart Benton finally told me, just get out. He couldn't handle it. He said, why don't you go to New York and just drink yourself to death or whatever? Well, he did. He went to New York and he started just getting on lighters and splashing paint around like this, you know, whatever. And boy, the people who are responsible for making a lot of this work are just a few writers who develop a rationale and a philosophy, an aesthetic philosophy around the meaning of this kind of work and get the proper kinds of dealers and handlers. It's a long, complicated story, but simplified to this extent that kind of market is clearly controlled through publicity and through, and the prices are really established, and I know of a number of instances where they tell one guy, look, John, you go in there, he's a millionaire, you buy this and you pay that much for it, and it'll establish a value for this, a value for you, and so on like that. And they put this all together, and lo and behold, they sell a lot of this stuff at these incredible prices, but it's all fixed in advance. And then they're all heroes, you know, and everybody writes about them, blah, blah, blah. There is no way that I could explain that any simpler. For example, Picasso probably wouldn't be anywhere close to where he is or was today if it hadn't been for Gertrude Stein and her brother, Leo, who was an international art dealer. They did have some money, and she was Miss Literati in Paris and was on top of the heap as a writer, but had other intentions and understood certain things about human nature, so she said. And she was right. She got a hold of Picasso when he was about 20 years old in Paris. And to see Picasso's paintings, when he was a much younger man, he was 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. He made paintings, certain copies of some of the old masters, that are literally indistinguishable from the old masters. You wouldn't believe it. I'd never seen that, nor had anyone else. But there was a book that I saw somewhere, a very rare edition, Picasso the early, before he got to be what he is. And he was on an impressionist track. He was really enthralled with that whole idea. He was sort of like Degas or someone. He was working with that idea. And Gertrude Stein got a hold of him, saw this guy's energy and his enthusiasm and his talent, and said, if you'll do what I tell you, we'll make a big hero out of you. It's going to take time, but you do as I say. So, believe it or not, this is a gross oversimplification of a very complicated story, but it's true. I got this confirmed from a variety of sources of people who are into it, who know the people, and this is a fact. And that she took him under her wing and said, now you do these things. And she told him what to do. She said, now you start making funny things, you will call it cubism. Make cubes out of stuff. Take objects and just break them up into a cubic form. And then she got that generated. Because he did something that no one has ever dreamed of before, hypothetically. And organized into a school, developed a rationale for it, had statements that govern it. And before long, it was in galleries that were frequented by dealers, and she persuaded them, and before long this got going. And she told him then at the time, she says, I will make you the largest, most significant single figure in the art world in this time. And she did. So 42 years. And Leo, as I said, her brother, who was quietly working behind the scenes with all his bread and his mat.